Hello, I'm Robert Bounds, and this is the Monocle Culture Show. We're taking a slightly different approach to the programme this week, and instead of focusing on one art exhibition, we're looking at the entire history of one gallery. And that one in question is the Hayward, the South Bank Centre's brutalist showground for contemporary art that's just celebrated its 50th birthday. Join me in the studio today for the birthday celebrations are Jane Morris, editor-at-large for the Art newspaper, and the architecture and culture writer Owen Hatherley. On the 9th of July 1968, the Hayward Gallery threw open its doors for the very first time. The angular building, perched on the edge of the Thames, is one of many results of the Festival of Britain that took place on the South Bank in 1951, a huge cultural event that celebrated a post-war Britain through the arts, industry and design. The Hayward's inaugural exhibition was a retrospective of Henri Matisse, and since then, it's been a temporary home to hundreds of artists, including Anish Kapoor, Tracy Emin, Jeremy Deller, and most recently, the current show, Lee Bull. The gallery is known for its big name shows and also for the building that it's housed in. But what was the cultural significance of it when it was built, and what does it mean to London today? Jane and Owen, welcome to the programme. Nice to have you both in the studio tackling, but not exclusively, the art and the building. Jane, I'll start with you. When was the first time you went to the Hayward Gallery? What did it feel like to enter those kind of unlikely big brutalist concrete walls?
Well, it's really interesting you say this, because I was trying to remember when the first show was, because the first one I could think of was a show called Double Take in 1992, which was this fantastic exhibition. It was curated, I think, by Lynn Cook, Beecher Courager. And it was basically a bunch of artists. They were supposed to be talking about memory and sculpture and video. And it was people like Mike Kelly and Glenn Ligon and Sophie Cowell and, you know, people I didn't really know. Having said that, looking at the exhibition list, I actually saw exhibitions before that. It was just from the top of my head.
Yeah.
That was one show that I immediately thought, yeah, that was great. The one that sticks in my memory probably the most, though, was in 1995, which is a show called Art and Power, Europe Under the Dictators. And it's an absolutely fantastic exhibition.
What a good topic, right?
So controversial. They built all sorts of things into the gallery space just to make these unusual sort of spaces. They had Nazi sculpture, they had Stalinist sculpture, they had artists who were rebels, they had artists who were state-sponsored. It was very, very controversial, and to me, just a fascinating show. I'd never seen anything like it.
And what does it mean, I wonder? Maybe Owen, I'll bring you in and we can kind of discuss the building and the art. But as a building on London's landscape, it's such a famous building, now back in favour, now that we love concrete, possibly helped by some of your books, and this sort of architecture. What does it mean to you?
Well, I mean, in many ways, what that whole complex has always meant is a particular public space, and I've always found it impossible to separate the Hayward Gallery out from Purcell Room and the Queen Elizabeth Hall and the NFT. Those things have always been this sort of complex, and that they're all completely together as this one sort of thing. And also as a sort of incredibly odd and interesting public space in the centre of London, full of sort of, you know, sort of odd corners and maze-like spaces and walkways, and the kind of relation to the river, which I think has been ruined a little bit by Benugo, but which I think is still basically there, of the book market in front of it. And that space is really one of the absolute best in London. I really couldn't imagine it without it in many ways.
There was a time when this architecture, we'll call it brutalist. We're right to call it brutalist.
In this case, definitely.
Yeah.
It doesn't get much more brutalist.
I know, it doesn't get much more brutalist. So it's a term that seems to be, it's got fashionable again recently. And so everything is brutalist.
Yeah.
I think we've got a brutalist salt mill at home.
The Facebook Brutalism Appreciation Society will definitely let you call this brutalist.
Okay, thank you. It's something that I remember going, and that's why I asked you, Jane, as well, actually, what it was like to go to it first. I found these places, I remember going to things at the Barbican and at the Hayward Gallery, on school trips and maybe with my parents up from the countryside and stuff, being kind of frankly terrified of these places.
Oh.
They seem to me about the kind of the alienation of urbanity somehow,
foreboding
somehow.
I have to say, I loved the Barbican and I loved the Hayward from the first time I set eyes on them.
Yeah, same.
I thought they were really exciting spaces, and they felt to me, I mean, I was at art school.
Yeah.
It just seemed to me this almost utopian. And I liked the kind of windswept, rather bleak nature of it, as I think, you know, one has a slightly romantic with a capital R windswept bleak moment over the Thames.
I mean, having grown up in Southampton, where she used to live far, for we have many brutalist buildings, didn't seem particularly alien. It was more like all of those kind of 60s architecture, all the sort of things that in somewhere like Southampton would be full of a sort of newsagent and a Tesco or otherwise would be derelict, was there full of all these sort of interesting cultural things that you just don't get in smaller cities in Britain. Fascinating thing about it for me was how sort of oddly relaxed it was, you know, that you had these bookstalls and you had art exhibitions and you had the skate park underneath, and you had all of these things kind of happening at once in this kind of quite laissez-faire way. It was a sort of public space, but one that hadn't been kind of programmed to within an inch of its life, of like, you know, the culture will happen here and, you know, the kids will jump about in a fountain here and this will happen there and the Wagamama will go there. And that it's lost a little bit, I think, in recent years.
Because I think, because it wasn't loved by a lot of people, there was a bit of a sense that you were in a bit of a community, wasn't there?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that you were kind of part of some special secret tribe in a way, that you actually liked these places.
Yeah, there is that. It's a funny one. What about, Jane, what is it like as a place to show art? It's obviously in its regional incarnation, and then when bits of it got covered up, I suppose, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, I'm not sure when bits of it got covered up, but now the famous skylight is back in all its glory, missing a bit. We'll come to Owen's bit about that later.
I'm not sure how long the famous skylight was ever there, because I feel like the roof leaked almost from the outset, but Owen might know better than
me on
that.
This was Henry Moore's design for the pyramid.
He was an advisor on it, and he was very keen to have these toplit spaces, which, I mean, I can understand why he was very keen to have these toplit spaces. It is a difficult space, actually, in some ways. I think what's most difficult about it, or at least a lot of curators feel is most difficult about it, is it's extremely difficult to do a chronological, linear exhibition through it. You can only do that by building a lot of walls and so forth, which doesn't look that great. Now, I think the interesting thing, though, is that it was intended as a very democratic building, and we might talk a bit about that, about the fact it was built by local authority architects. I mean, even the man it's named after, Sir Isaac Heywood, was actually a minor trade unionist. He was a champion of comprehensive school education. So it comes out of that 60s egalitarian New Britain. And not dictating to your audience how you go round an exhibition is sort of part of that. And I think that curators and artists who can live with that can do very nice shows in there. But if you want to do a very didactic show and lead people around in a particular way, it's not the space for it. I think some other people feel, I mean, I know Ralph Rugoff, the director, has said that a couple of painters turned down exhibitions there because they felt their work would be overwhelmed by the concrete building and the strong sort of sculptural lines of the building. I mean, painting can look very good in there. Mm. Ralph Rugoff did a great show, I think it was called Painting the Modern World or Painting Modern Life, which was a show about painting and photography, which worked very well in there. But perhaps some painters, I think, might not look so great in there. So you've got to pick the right artist and artists who like to work with that space.
What are a couple of key shows that have really worked in that space, that have worked with it or have been sort of antagonised by it, perhaps, and have won out over it, if that indeed is necessary?
Worked with it.
I mean, I thought the reopening show, the Andreas Gerstle, was
great.
Wonderful, and it kind of looked like it looked like it could be made for the building. It had the angularity, it had the modernity. It was such a perfect show, and the works were so large that they suited those big walls. You didn't have to do a salon hang and lose pictures right up in the top of the ceilings there.
Well, I mentioned Double Take, and that did look. That did. I mean, sculpture tends to look very good in there, which is perhaps not surprising. I mean, some of the shows I haven't seen, but there's actually done a collaboration with the Google Art Project, so you can actually look now at some of the historic images, some of which are fantastic. And I mean, there's pictures of Richard Long exhibitions, so circles of stones on the floor, which will obviously look really good in there. So I think in general sculpture looks good, but as I say, they've managed to make painters look good in there as well. You know, Andreas Gursky, large scale, large format photography.
Did you see the light show? I thought that was really good there. Yeah. That was a great use of the space, and it was strange. And maybe a kind of some works that were kind of difficult to swallow somehow or wouldn't work in other spaces just seem to lend themselves to that. And also that's that way where you can't walk around it in a right way, as it were.
Lends
itself to that discovery and not seeing the things you think you're going to like in the order you want to see them, I think, to that. The Haywood was closed for 2 years. It just reopened a couple of months ago with this Andrea Skursky show, and it hopped over the river into 180 The Strand, which is sort of used for all sorts of things. It was an office block, I think.
Yeah.
And then now it's been used for fashion shows and all sorts of different bits and bobs. Maybe it gave Ralph Rugoff kind of, he exercised his curatorial muscles in a kind of very lively and playful way.
So the show you're talking about is The Infinite Mix,
which was an amazing video show.
Extraordinary video show. I think it was 10 very large scale videos in this rather abandoned, disused concrete 70s office building, and some kind of big open plan sort of office building, so some really large spaces. No, I thought that was absolutely fantastic, and it really made me think the degree to which many curators are constrained by the spaces that they are working within. Now, sometimes that's no bad thing, because everyone needs disciplining features. And I suspect if people didn't have, for example, space restraints, we would end up with enormous, sprawling, great exhibitions, as we get at most of the Biennale, where people sort of are allowed to expand almost infinitely. But I thought that Ralph did something there that it's difficult to give video the right sort of space and enough sort of space, and that really worked. And it also attracted a very, very different audience. It was much younger. 80,000 people, I gather, went to see that.
Yeah.
And I thought it was one of the best shows of the decade.
There's an interesting thing, just following on that, and I'd like to talk about the kind of beginnings of the South Bank and what that meant and the Festival of Britain and all the things that came out of that in a sec. But I think, interestingly, I remember interviewing Ralph during that Infinite Mix show. And one of the big things that he was so proud to be able to do and get that diversity of audience was because it was free.
Yeah.
And you have to charge, because isn't the Haywood in Lambeth, or there's something, there is a council, there's a reason due to the council
that
you have to charge. You can't do it for free, but you are allowed to over the river, and I presume is Westminster. So it's a kind of very interesting thing. So he's like, it's great, I get to do stuff for free and all these different people come.
That I didn't know.
Yeah.
Although the Haywood, like everybody, has now, we're talking about a period, you know, the late 1960s when it seems that, you know, the government was very willing, or in this case, you know, it was GLC, wasn't it? It was Greater London Council by this point. You know, they were willing to invest in culture, whereas now the Haywood budget, I believe, is like, it's 40% roughly of its running costs, which is not the worst, but it's a lot lower than it used to be. So, you know, they have to raise money by every means possible, and I fear that ticket prices is one of them.
We're going to take a little break. We're going to come back and talk about the kind of foundation of the South Bank and all the rest of it. I'd like to talk to you about that, Owen. But we're going to have a little clip. I interviewed Ralph Rugoff a couple of months ago on the reopening of the Haywood Gallery. And this is what he had to say.
I think some artists like to have something to bounce off of. That friction really spurs creativity. And I think those artists who we work with who have that attitude, and I really think almost all good artists have that attitude, they love working in the Haywood because it poses a set of puzzles they have to work out. You know, if they just are showing their room, their work in a kind of neutral white cube type of space, there's no challenge there. There's nothing they can do to make that space feel different, to make it enhance the work in some way, to amplify your encounter with it. But when they come into the Haywood, they realize, okay, I'm going to use this space. It's another tool, really, in their own artistic kit.
And it's the 50th anniversary of the Haywood this year as well, 50th birthday maybe. Is it like resetting the kind of odometer on your motor car, that you can actually, you're on a fresh journey here, the building's been spruced, you've got more natural light. Does it feel like you're going on a new journey rather than continuing an old one?
Well, no, I think it definitely feels like a continuation. I wouldn't want to use the resetting the odometer of beating, which sounds like a dodgy practice if you're selling a used car. But I think, you know, it's more like you've just got a valve job on your car, and it's completely, you know, it can drive another 200,000 miles, and the engine is now purring in a way it hasn't done in a long time. I mean, it's just very exciting to have this kind of luminous, spacious gallery that has possibilities we're not even touching yet in this show, and to see what artists do with it.
we've obviously got the outside terraces, which were originally designed for sculptures, I think. I mean, these are going to be, I know you can't let too many cats out of the bag, but you're going to use the space in a very different way for the next show here.
We will. We'll open up all the windows upstairs. All the terraces will be open. There'll be work outside. There'll be work actually hanging from the outside of the building. So that'll be the actual 50th anniversary moment. So the Hayward's going to be looking like it's ready to go out at night.
Ralph Rogoff, then, cheerful, chipper mood. He kind of reminded me of Ed Roche when he was talking about analogizing it like it's had a valve job. I thought that was pretty good. In fact, I want those words written on a Roche.
Well, he famously did a big show with Roche, didn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, yeah. Owen, Ralph Rogoff, the director of the Hayward, talking about a nice quote, you know, when you're in the Hayward, you're in architecture. Maybe you can tell our listeners about the early 50s on the South Bank, what that project was aiming to do.
I mean, the key thing with the Hayward Gallery is that it's almost, although it's connected to the Royal Festival Hall, it's kind of aimed at it in a lot of ways. Although it kind of comes out of a site that comes from the Festival of Britain and this idea of having this kind of space in South London for, you know, for culture and leisure and so on. The building is not kind of ingratiating or kind of pleasant in the way that the Festival Hall is. The Festival Hall is very nice. It's spacious and bright and clear and logical. Sort of modernism in this kind of very kind of rationalist way. And the Hayward Gallery and the buildings connected to it is deliberately a mess, deliberately quite weird. I mean, the architects that designed it talked about one of their inspirations being the map in terraces, which was these kind of imagined, you know, sort of fake mountains at London Zoo, which were, you know, supposed to be kind of simulate this kind of wild landscape. So it's supposed to be kind of quite rough at the edges. It's supposed to be quite shaggy. And it's supposed to be anything but a white cube. And it's kind of good to sort of, you know, the curator sort of realizing that, because I often got the sense at various points that they desperately wished it was a white cube, which is just futile. One of the really striking things about it was the fact of it being such a public project and it being designed by a local authority employee, something which is incredibly difficult to imagine now. Like the GLA don't even own their own building, let alone, you know, and let alone are they able to like build an art gallery. I think that it's kind of managed to continue that in a way, continue that sense of it being a bit municipal and not really being ashamed of it.
Yeah.
I mean, the sort of places that it's most like aren't, you know, something like the Palais de Tokyo or whatever, but it's somewhere like Birmingham Central Library, you know, that sort of sense of these kind of massive and quite strange products of 60s social democracy that are probably at the time might have been considered sort of bureaucratic or what have you, but now seem immensely odd and avant-garde and jarring.
Can you read the politics or the reason that these places were built in the architecture itself, in the staircases that loom out and are now painted yellow, or the interior staircases, which are basically, to me, pieces of sculpture in their own right? Can you read the point of them being built in the architecture itself, I wonder?
I think you can read... what you can read is the fact that everything is public.
Mm.
That, you know, you can clamber all over it. That it has all of these kind of walkways and stairwells and sort of plazas and terraces that there's nothing stopping you from wandering around on and doing what you like with, which I think is something that I wish to sort of encourage a bit more than they do.
I think it's interesting, though, to put it back in the context of the time, because in a way it is incredibly uncompromising because, you know, we think, well, it opened with a Matisse show and how nice, the first Matisse show in London, but how nice but not very sort of avant-garde. But it's easy to underestimate how much modern art was disliked
in Britain at this period. 1968, right?
Which is sort of extraordinary to think of now. So in a way, I think it's quite interesting that you've got this rather disliked in some sections of the public art form. They put it in a pretty challenging gallery. They get Joanna Drew. She was head of the Arts Council art department because when it started, it was basically the Arts Council's gallery. So she was director of the gallery because it doesn't have a collection, although the Arts Council has a collection. You know, she was director of the Arts Council's art department. And she was a civil servant who was also the director of the Hayward Gallery. She's a hugely influential figure, actually, in the story of British modern art. And, you know, in her department, she had Julia Peyton-Jones, who became the director of the Serpentine. She had Nick Sirota, who became director of the Tate. She had Catherine Lampert, who became director of the Whitechapel. She was best friends with David Sylvester, you know, the great art critic. She was a very, very influential figure, but she took quite a lot of flack. And amongst the people she got flack from was William Rees-Mogg, who felt that modern art needed taking down a peg or two. Does that sound ever so slightly familiar?
Who would break a Matisse on a wheel?
So you know, the fact that they then, like, even 3 years later, were doing things like 30-year-old Los Angeles conceptual light artists, you know, they kept doing that all the time. I think there was always a very educational mix of, they would do a Picasso show. They even did some historical 19th century shows. And then they would go and do something really risky, 30-year-old Americans or conceptual art or something. And, you know, I think it's hard to sort of overestimate how important they were, because, you know, the Tate was the Tate at Milbank, and the Tate was much smaller then. It didn't actually have a large temporary exhibition space in 1968. It doesn't get one till 79. There was the Hayward, and, you know, there was the ICA with this mad anarchic artist-driven sort of programme in a kind of corner on the mall.
Yeah, exactly. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to do a bit of further reading. Now, don't make that face, Owen. You know what this is about. Now, you wanted to talk about the fact that it's not all roses. To any Londoner or any tourist or anyone driving across Waterloo Bridge would have seen Philip Vaughan's neon tower that was on the gallery until its refurb, I suppose. This is a bugbear of yours that it no longer exists, Owen.
Well, it's a bugbear, but partly because it seems connected with something that worries me a bit about the whole South Bank Centre complex at the moment, which is the fact that, despite the fact that they've just spent loads of money refurbishing it and it now looks lovely and you can actually see out of the roof lights, which is progress, they're desperately trying for it not to be listed, which has happened repeatedly. And I really would have thought that after that, you know, that they'd sorted it out, they would then actually back a listing application. Instead, they blocked it. But they managed to get, like, a certificate of immunity from listing, which, among other things, means that legally it could be knocked down in the next couple of years if they wanted to, which they almost certainly don't. And I presume that the reason that they don't want it to be listed is so that they can still build an extension on top of it. I mean, a few years ago, there was a proposal to sort of have a sort of glass box suspended on top, very much in the place where the Neon Tower, which was placed there in 1972 and stayed there, I think, for about, till about 2016, I think.
So you smell a rat in the removal of the Philip Vaughan.
Well, no, I mean, they specifically said when it was removed, this is in the place where our extension is going to be. That's why we're removing it. And the fact they've not put it back, despite the fact that they've now, you know, made it nice, I think suggests, along with the fact that they've so strongly opposed it being listed, that they still quite like the idea of putting a huge bit of glass on top of it, which I think is not really what the building needs.
What does that do to a building like that?
Well, I mean, it's such an odd way to look at it. And I think it's because the building is so tactile, it's so physical. And to kind of put a sort of glass box, which is always the sort of thing that you do with, like, a historic building, is, let's put some glass on it because glass is opaque and you can't see glass, which, of course, is not actually the case. Like, usually it can be very intrusive. So on that level, I'm still a little bit kind of like, that despite the fact that if you go to the gallery shop now, it's got like 500 books about brutalism and build your own brutalist building model kits, they still seem to kind of want to hang on to the idea that they can bugger it up any time.
Maybe they should put like a sort of conservatory from the 80s on the top, because everyone just does
clear
glass extensions. Let's just put like a chintzy 80s conservatory on it.
There were several proposals in the 80s to do exactly this.
Oh, wow. I thought I was joking. I always think I'm joking when I'm talking about this stuff, and then it always happened at some point. Before we leave it, I always loved that neon tower. I thought it was a lovely thing. It's a good thing as well, isn't it? I wonder where it is. Let's dust it off. Let's bring it back.
Yeah, I mean, I think it needs quite a lot of conservation doing on it, but I mean, conserving these things is not beyond the wit of man or woman.
Jane, you wanted to talk, I should say at the beginning, that the Hayward doesn't have a collection. It puts on these temporary shows. It's about loans, it's about favours, and therefore it can be nimble. We understand that's a Kunsthalle system. Well, that's what it's called it's a German word, but that's what we tend to call it in Europe. Talk to us about what you mean with this, and specifically with reference to the ICA, the Institute of Contemporary Arts down on the Mall.
Well, I think it's just that, you know, thinking about this, and I was thinking about what was already in London when the Hayward opened, and obviously there was vastly less modern and contemporary art to see than there is now. I mean, really vastly less. And I kept thinking about how actually for quite a long time, a good sort of 10 years, the Hayward really was the main modern and contemporary place to see art. And that explains this programme, which, as I say, was this kind of unusual mix and had quite an educational feel to it. But you know, in a good way. So you'd get impressionists, but then you get something really cutting edge. And that carried on for many years. Now you can see under Ralph Rogoff, it has become much more obviously contemporary. And that does make sense because now there are major modern exhibitions at Tate Modern. There's Tate Britain has several large exhibition bases and so on and so on. But I kept thinking about the fact that one of the things that you get in New York, you get in some of the big German cities, are spaces that are quite large and quite rough, but are really much more about artists, cutting edge young artists, not just making, you know, visual arts. They could be in architecture, they could be in dance, they could be in music. And you have these spaces where people come together and it's very flexible and very risky. And some of the stuff will kind of be a bit rubbish, although it might not be, the artist may be good in 10 years' time. And sometimes it can be really fantastic. And that's what the ICA is supposed to be. And I was really just thinking of this problem of the fact that the one thing we do miss is somewhere where you can go and see this really quite emerging scene, I think. You get bits of it here and there, you know, you get a bit at the Zabludovich collection. I often mention them because they do these sort of young artists. But if you wanted to get a real sense of what's going on in Europe or America or Asia or London in that younger group, you've really got the ICA, and it is incredibly hampered, I think, by that pokey building on the Mall, which, you know, people say it's a great location, but I think, is it? I think I'd rather be, I don't know, I'd almost rather be in Deptford or somewhere, you know. And
I've always just enjoyed how surreal it is in the spot that it's in, just in this, you know, in like the centre of like imperial tourist London, and you've got this thing there.
And well, of course, it was founded by surrealists, and I could sort of really see it working then.
Mm. Yeah, it's a funny one, isn't it? It is. It's not a place walking into, like, what looks like almost like a stable door.
Yeah.
And then you're into this kind of weird, low slung, deep kind of place, which now seems to be so unideal for showing.
Well, it's had so many problems as well. I mean, I think the programme was really improving under Gregor Muir, who's now gone to the Tate. Stefan Kalmar has come over from New York. And again, the programme is already looking interesting. It just seems to me that, I don't know, I would just like to see, in the same way Ralph Rogoff was freed by going to that huge building, that huge, you know, ex-office block, I would sort of like to see the ICA freed up in the same way.
Yeah, right. That would put some wind in its sails, possibly. Thank you both very much indeed. That brings us to the end of today's show. Thank you to my guests, Jay Morris and Owen Hatherley, and to my producer, of course, Holly Fisher. We'll be back at the same time next week when we'll be discussing the Now That's What I Call Music compilation albums. You could. Do you want to come back and do that one as well?
I don't think I'm the right person. Oh, God. Anyone growing up in the 80s, how could we forget them?
It's going to be Now 100 next
when
week.
When was the first one?
Oh, when was it? 82? No, it must be 84 or something.
God, I fear I probably remember that.
I think,
that.
Yeah. That's great. Well, we've veered massively off script until next week then. I've been Robert Bounds, and thank you very much for tuning in.